The next case on our oral calendar today is in the matter of the civil commitment of Takvin, and I never know whether it's Lee or Lai.
Lee, Your Honor.
Lee, all right, thank you. I'm certain that I've pronounced it both ways over time. I felt like it. Maybe we should announce this case as in the matter of deja vu, because it seems that we're circling an issue again that we've considered recently in a different matter involving the same individual. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 to appellant's counsel that you may use for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, and I don't have to advise you that you can raise or lower the lectern because you've already been there many times. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. You may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent appellant Scott County. There's two primary issues in this case that I intend to address today, and I'm happy to take questions on any other aspects. But the first is whether there is a statutory right to charge the county for attorney's fees under the Civil Commitment Act. And the second is whether the contract between the parties requires or authorizes fees to be charged to the county under these circumstances. So those are the two primary issues. The facts are pretty similar to the last case, for two of you is similar.
Except the contract issue is obviously developed differently in this case.
Contract, it's the same contract. It's very similar.
But I mean the issues that are now up before
yes.
us.
Yes, the judges, Judge King on Swope, dealt with it slightly differently than Judge Wilton in Lee. So that is, and I did mainly defer to the court on the contract issue in Swope.
So in this case, there wasn't an evidentiary hearing, was there?
On
the questions of the contract, and you know, the district court concluded there was a course of dealing that suggested that these fees would be included under the contract. There wasn't an evidentiary hearing on that.
Correct, there was not.
So how was the evidence presented? I think there was an affidavit from one of the lawyers, Mr. Conway.
Yes, he submitted the contract by affidavit after the parties argued the case, but there was otherwise not a hearing. And so the judge, in part, Judge Wilton, relied on his own experience to decide whether there was a course of dealing with the contract. And Judge Wilton also relied upon the plain language of the contract to find that it was ambiguous without actually addressing all the language in the contract, specifically the non-waiver clause. So it's impossible to find waiver and the intent of the parties without addressing a non-waiver clause that is plainly in the contract. So the standard of review for contracts, which I can just jump right to that, is well established, and that's nothing new. The primary goal is to determine and enforce the intent of the parties. The court considers the plain language of the contract. When the language is unambiguous, it should be given its plain meaning. To determine whether the contract is ambiguous, courts should read the words and phrases not in isolation, but should consider their meaning in the context of the contract as a whole. A contract must be interpreted in a way that gives all of its provisions meaning. And finally, whether the language is plain or ambiguous is a question of law, which this court reviews de novo. So on the contract issue, if this court determines that the contract alone does authorize fees, this court still needs to reverse and remand this issue because there was no determination of what was due solely under the contract. So up and through the end of December of 2022, when the contract terminated, if fees are due under the contract alone, that would have to be determined still, and it wasn't. So if that's the case, there's still a reverse and a remand on that issue.
But your argument is that whether there's an ambiguity is a question of law that wouldn't require remand?
Yes, correct. And so I am asking this court to reverse and find that the contract does not create a separate liability. Based on the contract language, the plain language of the contract that the parties negotiated in 2018, signed in 2018, and went into effect on 2019.
But you would agree that course of dealing of the parties can serve to modify even an unambiguous contract?
Absolutely.
And why should we not agree with the district court here that the party's course of dealing, in fact, did just that?
Because he never addressed it. He never addressed the non-waiver provision of the contract. So it can, a non-waiver can be waived if it is established and if there is evidence to support it. And in this case, that was never raised. That was never considered by the district court overtly. So he's relying, he being the judge, was relying on his own experience from 10 years ago and on Jim Conway's experience from 15 years ago. All of that predates the contract signed in 2018 that the law firm renegotiated that specifically contained non-waiver clauses that specifically said all of the language that's outlined in my respondent's brief, that this is the entire agreement. Nothing can alter this except in writing, reduced to writing exactly as this is. And all of that included the non-waiver provisions. And that was brought up at the hearing, both hearings actually, in front of Judge Wilton and in front of Judge Weber when it was brought up again, that simply because it has been done before doesn't mean that this is the way it always is. And in front of Judge Weber in particular, the non-waiver provision was raised. So this was brought up that the state or that Scott County had not waived it by the course of conduct.
Is it the Cervinka affidavit that includes that evidence of prior payments?
Of one, correct.
Great. And then, so would that be enough to say that's not clearly erroneous on the finding that there was a course of dealing?
No, because that was one instance at the county's request for an attorney to attend a meeting. That's nothing near what was described by the district court judge and Jim Conway at the hearing, and contradicted by the county, by Jeannie Anderson, who argued it, and by the affidavit of Tracy Cervenka.
If we say there's not enough, there's the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding a course of dealings, your argument would be we still have to remand because the district court didn't consider the non-waiver provision and they need to do that first?
Yes. So primarily first, as a matter of law, right now, reverse the district court. But if not, a remand for exactly that. And again, that's if liability is based on contract alone, not the statute. If the statute requires fees, it flows through the contract. We have to pay fees. Scott County agrees with that. So turning to the statutory issue, unless there's further questions on the contract. Similarly to last time, in Minnesota law, attorney's fees can only be charged to the county if permitted by a contract or authorized by the legislature in a statute. And there is a fee-shifting statute in the Minnesota that the Minnesota legislature has passed, and that's in the Civil Commitment Act, and that allows for fees under the Civil Commitment Act. So in each proceeding under this chapter, the court shall allow, and it goes on, for travel, for time spent in court, or in preparing for the hearing. So that's the hearing under the Civil Commitment Act. Court-appointed attorneys under the Civil Commitment Act are entitled to fees paid by the county. There is no statute that authorizes fee shifting to sue the Commissioner of Human Services for treatment under the Civil Commitment Act. This court has held that multiple times. In Travis, in Navratil, in Wicks. Now, in this case, Judge Wilton relied upon the mandamus statute to find that mandamus was a necessary corollary to enforce treatment. But mandamus isn't even the statute that's referenced in the Civil Commitment Act. That's the habeas. And there's no mention of mandamus under the act. Completely insufficient to require the county to have to pay. And again, the Civil Commitment Act itself does reference habeas, but it's not incorporating habeas. It's saying nothing here shall be construed to abridge the right of any person to bring the writ of habeas corpus.
And your argument at its fundamental base is that the mandamus and habeas proceedings are not a commitment proceeding under
Correct.
The Act.
Correct.
Or part of the commitment proceeding.
And that's consistent with Wicks and Navratil and Travis. In fact, in Navratil, this court stated that a committed person has adequate avenues outside the commitment process for asserting a right to treatment issue, referencing the writ of habeas corpus and all of the other, both federal and state procedures that a person can pursue in order to obtain treatment. But those are all treatment-focused litigation, and that is what this is as well. The 48-hour rule is a right to treatment issue. This came up sort of at the end of the last argument as to whether it's a proceeding under the Civil Commitment Act, and it's not. The 48-hour rule is called the priority admissions statute by the Supreme Court recently in Lye versus Harpstead last month, where it described the statute where, at the time, the priority admissions statute required that covered patients must be admitted to a state-operated treatment program within 48 hours. That's all about treatment. That's only about treatment. That is not under the Civil Commitment Act.
It's not often that you get asked a question, an oral argument, and then you leave and then are able to find the answer and are able to argue again the next week.
That's it is it. Really nice. Unless there are any other questions, I don't have anything else that I feel like I need to cover right now. I'll certainly have any rebuttal for anything else that comes up.
Doesn't appear as if the panel has any questions right
Thank
now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Mallory Stoll. I represent the respondent in this proceeding, Jaspers, Moriarty, and Weatherall. Your Honor, respondent requests that this court affirm the orders issued by the district court regarding the issues that have been raised on appeal. The district court correctly concluded that a person subject to civil commitment has a right to court-appointed counsel in the parallel mandamus or habeas proceeding that took place in this case, to enforce the right that is set forth under the Act. Also, that the court-appointed attorney has the right to be paid for the work that they do. I plan to focus my argument really on this issue, not on the Lodestar method. I think I'm going to just rest on my brief with that. At its core, this case and the Swope case, to be fair, are really not about a right to treatment. It's about the right to transfer to treatment. In this case and in the Swope case, it's specifically about the right to transfer from jail, where someone is housed, after a finding of incompetency and subsequent civil commitment.
What's the link between the Commitment Act and this transfer right? How does this right to transfer under the 48-hour rule part of a commitment proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, the mandamus and habeas proceedings, frankly, wouldn't exist but for the rights that are guaranteed under the Act. So in this case, we have the priority admission statute that was in effect at the time. That's why it's a proceeding under the Act. It's directly and inextricably intertwined with one another. I will also note, I'm going to get to some of the cases that appellants cited in their brief, but one I would also point the court's attention to if there is any question or doubts. Hey, does the different court file number really matter? I'll turn to the Heffler matter. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case, I believe from 1985, cited in the Moen case. In that case, the Supreme Court determined that someone has a right to court-appointed counsel in proceedings before a special review board. A special review board isn't a judge, but the right to counsel still was found to be something that is guaranteed under the Act, and I would say what follows is that attorney has the right to be paid.
Is the language the same? Proceeding under the act in that?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'm going to say I believe so. I don't want to speak incorrectly on that. I did say I'm going to turn right to the cases, Judge Bjorkman, that I just said. Appellant really leans heavily on several cases that are readily distinguishable from the facts of this case.
May I ask, before you jump into the cases, I have a question about the right to transfer.
Yes.
Was that briefed? Was that in your brief and in your appeal in this case about right to transfer?
I don't believe it was phrased exactly that way, Judge Schmidt, but ultimately, if we look at the core of this case and what is at the heart of this case, it's not the issues that we see where we find the right to treatment language that is set forth in the cases Navratil, Moen, Brooks, et cetera. This case is distinguishable, and I don't think anyone understood it differently, that this is about someone who's sitting in jail that is not being transferred. So those words were not used, but I think it's very clear that that is what the district court decided below. I want to turn now to the cases that I just cited and how they are readily distinct.
Before we leave that, I mean, I understand the language is different, transfer as opposed to treatment, but the statutory right to transfer is to obtain treatment. So I'm having a hard time making the distinction between a proceeding for treatment and a proceeding for transfer.
I think that the facts and circumstances surrounding this case and the Swope case is what informs the answer to that question, Your Honor. With Mr. Lee, the fact that he was in jail for months, not in perhaps a facility that was more restrictive than necessary, not in the community, he was in jail. And that implicates a significant liberty interest that, based on the cases that appellant cites, are not issues in those cases and that can't be underemphasized or ignored. And I think that is a very significant distinction between those cases and this case. When we look at the critical distinctions, I do want to start with the Epperson case. I will acknowledge that some of the cases are non-precedential, but I'm assuming perhaps the court may find them persuasive, so I want to address those concerns head on. In the Epperson case, Mr. Epperson was committed as a chemically dependent individual. In this case, Mr. Lee was not committed as a chemically dependent individual. It was a mentally ill person who posed a risk of harm, and the underlying petition started because of the fact he was found incompetent in the criminal proceedings. Next, Mr. Epperson was at a detox facility. He wasn't in jail. In detox, if we think about what that entails, someone who is at that facility is surrounded by medical professionals, cared for by trained professionals to monitor their symptoms, to make sure that any withdrawal that they have in detoxification is done in a safe and healthy way. The professionals have necessary medical training to assist those people. In contrast, Mr. Lee was in a jail cell.
Right. I understand the argument you were making, but I get back to the Commitment and Treatment Act. I know it's called Commitment and Treatment, but the scope of a commitment proceeding, and I think the reason why the legislature provided for counsel for someone whom the county is trying to commit, civilly commit against their will, I mean, it all culminates in a decision whether they should be committed or not. And I appreciate the what happens after that decision is made is very important to the committed person, and a lawyer may have ethical and professional obligations to continue representation to the extent there is this languishing in the jail instead of being transferred. But I'm not sure how it implicates the statutory right to have someone represent you in connection with the decision whether you should be committed or not. You see what I mean?
I think I do, Your Honor. So I already spoke briefly about the Heffler matter, some other responses I would give to that. Under the Act, a person has the right to court-appointed counsel for the duration of the proceedings. It extends beyond that initial commitment. What I think is also very important to point out is the Act does not provide someone with the ability expressly to represent themselves, and that makes sense. We're generally dealing with people who are incapacitated, who have very significant needs. So if we think about the people that are really at the heart of these cases and the fact that they have the right to court-appointed counsel at all proceedings, and Heffler says even beyond the underlying commitment themselves, no one has disputed that mandamus was the appropriate path to get Mr. Lee what he needed. And so if we take that a step further, if there wasn't a right to court-appointed counsel, how would that be vindicated? Well, you still have your attorney that is in the underlying civil commitment case that's supposed to be representing you, but you don't get an attorney there. We have an incompetent person who is potentially expected to figure out how to do a writ of mandamus or writ of habeas corpus on their own. And I also think it's significant, Judge Bjorkman, that the Act itself under 253B.23 subdivision 5 explicitly references that the Act is not intended to abridge the right of any person to a writ of habeas corpus. Why would the legislature put that in there if they're just saying that it's a right that already exists? There has to be something that that means.
Well, and it can mean just what it says, that this is not designed to erode or replace the right to habeas.
But I think that Mr. Lee or anyone who may have a colorable claim to file a petition for writ would have those rights whether or not that's in there. So,
but to answer your question, I mean, as far as rights go, we're really talking about the payment here. I mean, if a law firm agrees to represent a client, and in order to meet all the needs of the client, there has to be separate proceedings, and the law firm is aware, based upon the statute, that some of the proceedings might be covered, and proceedings in a different avenue might not be covered. I mean, the individual is still protected. The individual still has an attorney, the attorney who agreed to take on the case, recognizing that some of the fees would be covered by the state and some of the fees would not be covered by the state. Why isn't that a fair approach to the statute?
I don't have any specific statute or case to cite to, Your Honor, but I think it would be an odd decision that came out that said court-appointed attorneys who have very important jobs, you get to be paid for some things but not others. And then in this case, it became much more than that. It became, we're going to scrutinize, and when I say we, I'm talking about, in the civil commitment proceeding, the opposing party, the opposing attorney. We're going to go through and scrutinize what things we think are and are not covered under the Act. And we can not only, what happened in this case, withhold payment for anything based on an erroneous interpretation of the contract, but we can also pick and choose what we do and do not pay you for. I can't understand how we would get there. That would be my response.
I ask you, assuming we disagree with you on the statutory interpretation, I'm just asking to turn your attention to the contract, because there are different issues that arise under the contract. And the district court here concluded made a determination that the party's past course of dealing, in a sense, modified the contract, and in such a way that the contested fees should be paid. I'm struggling with the evidence available to the court on that point and whether the issue of the contract's non-waiver provision was adequately litigated and decided.
Judge Bjorkman, I appreciate your acknowledgement that, and what I wanted to say too is I don't think we need to get to the commitment issue if the district court's determinations regarding what the statute provides is sufficient. But looking to that, So what I had written down when opposing counsel was asked about this, first, there are several affidavits in the record, and my recollection is that at least one of the affidavits of Mr. Conway sets forth the history and the numerous cases where this happened. Perhaps I'm not thinking about this exactly correct, but I'm thinking of an affidavit being a sworn statement. It's in the record. The court could consider it. I mean, I think that that could potentially wade into the area of a credibility determination, and I don't know how, I don't think that it would be appropriate for this court to question that.
An evidentiary hearing. So can the district court be making the credibility determinations when it's not an evidentiary hearing and it's just based on affidavits?
I can tell you it happens all the time in family law. We have motions to modify parenting time. There absolutely are credibility determinations that are made based on motions.
So the district court also, though, relied on its own experience in terms of the course of dealings. Is that appropriate evidence for a district court to be relying on and making that determination?
I don't know. And I think that's the best answer I can give you right now.
That's fair. I have another question about the contract, whether that is an independent basis. The language of the contract says that it is it flows through the statute. That's the argument anyway, is that the county will not pay for any, or will pay for any work that's performed in violation of the law, will not pay for that, as in the law does not authorize such work. That's the language from the contract. So is the contract, unless it's course of dealing, is there an independent basis in the contract for fees?
Let me just pull that.
Because I think the county concedes that if the statute provides fees, then it necessarily flows through the contract.
And so, Your Honor, I'm looking at page 2, number 2 of the contract. So I see unsatisfactory or performed in violation of the laws. And so I thought I heard you say another term that I don't see in the contract. I read this, and Judge Bjorkman, the district court did determine the contract was, the terms were ambiguous that were at issue. I do see my time is up. Judge Ross, may I finish Judge Mitch's question? So when I read that term, it says if it's unsatisfactory, which I don't recall seeing any reference to a word or a synonym thereof by the county as a basis to withhold payment, or performed in violation of. I guess when I read in violation of, and perhaps there's a different school of thought on this, I read it like you're not allowed to do that work, not that a court-appointed attorney perhaps is, well, as happened in this case, an open question of whether a court-appointed attorney has the right to be paid for that. The only other piece I'll say on the contract that I'd written down, and I think this might have been in response to your question, Judge Bjorkman, because you had a two-part question. The non-waiver issue and the reverse and remand, all I want to say on that is, I believe that issue was presented to the district court, and I think the district court not relying upon that, I think, is evidence that it rejected that argument. Certainly, the court has can review that, but I don't think that a remand is necessary. I would just ask that this court affirm.
I have another question, if I may.
Yes.
So let's say the statute doesn't exist. Would the contract alone provide the right to fees? Because that's the basis of the district court's two-part ruling, that one, the contract is an independent basis separate from the statute. So we say the statute doesn't exist. So do you think the contract then by itself provides for fees?
Yes. I would rely on C of the recitals on page 1 that talks about the needed provision of legal representation to individuals in cases requiring attorneys appointed by a judge of the court, which includes civil commitments. So the way I view it is if a district court judge appointed counsel, this contract would apply. And if we go further to, I believe it's starting on page 2 with scope of services, it most certainly would provide a basis for payment. I do think that the way that I really would construe the contract argument is it certainly can't be used as a basis to limit Mr. Lee's right to court-appointed counsel. If anything, it expands upon that. So I just wanted to add that. All right, I don't see any other questions, so I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Todd Zettler, again for Scott County, the appellant. The right to counsel is not the same as the right to have the county pay for it. We're not here challenging the right to counsel. We're only here challenging the right to have the county pay for it. There's no constitutional right to counsel in civil commitment proceedings. It is only statutory. And with that, I would ask this court to reverse and remand unless there are any other questions.
Looks like you're free to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again to both counsel. We certainly will issue our opinion within the statutory period. We appreciate your briefing and your oral argument. Very helpful. Interesting case, interesting legal issue. With that, this is our last case on our oral calendar, so the court is in recess. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.